Chapter 33. At dawn, Thomas joined the villagers, who weren't too hungover from the previous night's festivities, for the launch of the outrigger race to Papeete and back. Each of the 12 18-foot boats would be launched into the surf and paddled by two men, one on the left side, where the Ama float was located, and one on the right. In ancient times, the construction of a canoe was a religious event, shared by boat builders, laborers, priests, and chiefs. Most boats were carved from a single tree and fitted with sails woven from pandanus leaves. Such outriggers were regarded as living entities with their own spiritual mana. Today's canoes had sails made from canvas, and only a few of the oldest men still held a spiritual regard for them. But each canoe continued to be fashioned from a single tree, and they were the lifeblood of Tahitian transportation, fishing, pearl-shell diving, and va'a, the race. To win a race was a great honor, and every young man longed to have a victory lay draped over his head at least once in his lifetime. 8 hours of paddling with no rest, said Aubert as he came up alongside Thomas. The artist seemed remarkably fresh-eyed and robust for someone who had consumed at least 3 bottles of wine by himself only hours earlier. He looked out across the line of young men waiting for the order to push their canoes into the water and paddle across the reef and into the open sea, and said, "I could be wrong, Thomas, but I don't believe that any of those boys were with us at the celebration last night." "Of course they weren't, Monsieur Artiste," cackled a toothless old woman as she passed behind them and slapped Aubert on his rear. "A drunken sailor can't raise his mast any more than a drunk painter can unfurl his canvas." Aubert feigned a shocked look, made an exaggerated bow, and replied, "My wife would beg to differ, dear mother, but then such is the superiority of the French constitution." The old woman and her friends howled with laughter as they walked past, and Thomas watched as the woman raised one hand in the air and mimicked the words, "French lover," before letting her forefinger droop slowly until it was pointed to the sand. Thomas managed a half-smile at the antics, but his mind was focused on the match against Aata to be held this afternoon, and on Keani. They hadn't exchanged a word, of course, nor would they, but it was not the fact that she was mute that kept him from speaking to her. It was the suffocating presence of her friends, family, and especially of Aata and his very watchful warriors. He had not been alone with her, written to her, or done so much as walk with her along the beach, and yet the stirring he felt inside each time he thought of her or caught a glimpse of her going about her business in the small village was something he had never experienced. He had known women, desired them, pursued them, and bedded more than a few willing partners since his first bedroom experience 6 years earlier with Tydia Fraiche, the buxom Ohio farmer he had encountered on his way home from the war. He could not deny his physical desire for Keani, the way her simple linen dress clung to her hips, breasts, and buttocks when she walked, was mesmerizing. But there was more rumbling around inside his head than primitive lust, much more. The way she held her head with an almost regal serenity, the softness of her smile, the mischievous glint in her eyes, the cascade of thick hair that flowed in waves nearly to her waist. As for her being mute, he had experienced more communication in the few simple glances they had exchanged than he had known with any woman. As McNabb waved him over to where a crowd was gathering to watch one of the events, he knew he was going to have to find a way to steal even just a minute with her. "I'm sorry," Thomas said to McNabb, who was standing next to a post from which a bright blue ribbon stretched 10 feet to another post across the path. "But did you say this was a fruit carrier race, as in fruit?" The captain lit a fresh bowl of tobacco and chuckled. "Exactly, and you are going to be impressed." "By a coconut racing a pineapple along a footpath?" "Be patient, lad. You'll understand soon." The sound of a gunshot in the distance cut McNabb off, and the villagers lining both sides of the path began to cheer and yell out the names of their favorite runners. "For fruit," Thomas thought to himself. "I don't think I will ever understand these people." A few moments later, McNab tapped his shoulder and pointed off to the north, where the path emerged from a thick wall of greenery. Thomas strained to see what was happening and to hear over the din of the crowd, who were growing more animated by the second. Then there was a flash of movement at the tree line, 200 yards distant. Then another, and another, until Thomas could make out the forms of several men running full speed towards the village, and the outline of the thick 5-foot pole each was holding on his shoulders behind his neck. More runners poured out of the woods until at least a dozen men were racing towards the compound. That's when Thomas could finally see the tightly bound bundle of coconuts and bunches of green bananas dangling from each end of their poles. He turned to McNab and raised his eyebrows, his expression a combination of disbelief and amazement. "Each man is carrying upwards of 100 pounds of fruit," said the captain, "and the race is just over a mile long."
"It's..." Thomas began.
"Ain't it, though?"
As the runners drew closer, Thomas saw that they had leaf garlands on their heads, wore only loincloths, and were barefoot. From the way their bodies shone in the sun, it also appeared that each man had been liberally coated with coconut oil on his chest, arms, back, and legs. Two stocky young men pulled away from the pack as they neared the village, and they crossed the finish line together, tossing their fruit-laden poles on the ground and acknowledging the cheers and applause of the crowd. And Thomas noticed the openly inviting stares of the young maidens. The rest of the runners quickly followed until there was a huge mound of poles and fruit covering the ground in front of the cook shack. Aubert and Boswell joined them, and the four men went down near the water's edge, where sharpened metal stakes had been jammed upright into the sand for the coconut husking competition. One woman stood beside each stake where 10 unhusked coconuts had been piled. Thomas noted that at least 3 of the 11 women were quite elderly. When Varua clapped his hands, each woman picked up a single coconut and began jamming it down on the tip of the pole, turning the nut in their hands rapidly, pulling it back up and then striking again and again. Thomas estimated that the fastest woman took less than 4 seconds to completely husk each of their coconuts. In less than a minute, one of the elderly competitors, the same toothless grandmother who had teased Aubert earlier, finished her 10th coconut and stepped away from her pole to the cheers of the crowd. "It would appear, gentlemen, that the winner has husked a nut or two in her time," said Aubert with a chuckle and a wave to the winner. Now the crowd moved up from the beach to where 3 60-foot palm trees grew in a straight line. At the foot of each tree, a husky young man was tying a piece of cloth around his ankles and securing it tightly. When Varua shouted a command, the men hopped forward, wrapped their arms around their tree in a tight hug, pulled their feet up level with their midsections, and they began to shimmy in small frog hops up the tree. Thomas was amazed to see the winner reach the top of his tree in 6 seconds. The game swirled on around them for the next several hours. Teams of 3 men each hacked open and split as many as 100 coconuts in 4 minutes. Children did foot races and acrobatics. Men of all ages tossed long, reed-thin javelins at coconuts suspended 30 feet in the air, and in a contest Thomas deeply wished a coney could have been present for, the strongest men in the village lifted great stones weighing nearly 300 pounds up to chest height.
"The swimming events will take place after lunch," McNab told his friends as the crowd began moving towards the cook shacks and the tables laden with fish, pork, roast chicken, cheese, fruits, and breads.
"And so will wrestling," he added as he placed a hand on Thomas's shoulder. "I'm sure you will want to prepare."
The captain was surprised by Thomas's wordless reply, a simple smile and nod of the head.
Boswell, McNab, and O'Bear piled their plates high with the village's bounty, while Thomas settled for a spoonful of fruit and a small portion of roast pork.
"I suppose you don't want to wrestle on a full stomach," Boswell added.
"Something like that," said Thomas. McNab slapped his hand on the edge of the table.
"Damn your hide, Colonel, but you don't seem to appreciate the seriousness of the situation. Aara nearly killed the last man who faced off with him. He choked off the flow of oxygen to the poor fool's brain for so long that he still drools uncontrollably."
Thomas seemed bemused. "And what was Aata's style in this competition?" he asked calmly.
"His style?" sputtered the captain.
What does that mean?"
"I mean, how did he fight? What technique did he employ? What strategy?" McNab was clearly agitated, and so O'Bear cut in.
"Thomas, we are your friends. You are about to come up against the strongest warrior and best athlete, probably in all of Tahiti. We do not wish to see you maimed or killed, and so forgive Captain McNab, and me for that matter. We simply do not understand your lack of concern."
"And as for his style, as you put it, Thomas," McNab finally said, "he stood straight, grabbed his opponent in a bear hug, swung him to the ground, and dropped onto his back and began choking him."
"With his hands or his arms?" Thomas asked.
McNab swept his pewter mug of wine aside and stood to go. His face was red and his lips were pursed. Boswell shot Thomas a questioning glance.
"Please, Captain, sit down," Thomas said in a quiet voice. "Please."
McNab took his seat as the crowd around them began clearing their tables and preparing for the next round of the games.
"Well, I am concerned, of course," said Thomas,
"but not for myself."
His friend looked at him as if he had just gone mad.
"Aata will not defeat me," Thomas went on in a serious tone. "In fact, the only concern I have is whether I should hurt him more or humiliate him more. Either way, he will lose face with the villagers, and Varua will quite probably lose a brother-in-law."
O'Bear lit another cigar and leaned forward.
"Thomas, I think it's time to explain yourself."
Thomas pushed his plate away. "When I was a boy in Ohio, my father taught me just three things: how to ride a horse, how to play cards, and how to fight. And by fighting, I don't just mean fisticuffs." His friends were silent, hanging on his every word. "My father was raised outside Paris, on his grandfather's estate. The grounds included several acres of manicured gardens, and the old man in charge had been born and raised on the island of Okinawa."
"I know it well," said McNab. "I have sheltered the Kai Douglas there many times."
Thomas nodded. "The old man was called Taishi, and from childhood he had been trained in the fighting arts known as Shurite, which originated on the island over 1,000 years ago."
"I have heard of these Oriental methods," said O'Bear, "but I have never met anyone with any knowledge of them. In fact, I thought they were only legends."
"Many people thought that right up until the first time they confronted a Shurite master in one-on-one combat."
"And you are trained in this technique?" asked Boswell.
"My father studied with the old gardener for his entire childhood, until he left France for America when he was 19. He trained me until he died when I was 15. For what it's worth, I am quite good."
"Good enough to beat a highly skilled Tahitian warrior?" mused McNab.
"I would not dare to compete with him with spears," said Thomas. "But I have never been bested in a fight. I was the champion wrestler in the 109th Ohio Regiment, too."
Most of the villagers had made their way over to an open patch of grass on which a chalk circle about 20 feet across had been drawn.
"This shurite is a boxing technique?" asked O'Bear.
"It relies on speed and agility and combines Western and Eastern punching, grappling, kicking, and throwing."
"Kicking?"
asked McNab.
From a standing position, I can kick a 6-foot-tall man hard enough to break his jaw, Thomas answered. Aubert noticed that there was no braggadocio in his friend's voice. He was simply stating a fact. Thomas stood and looked at his friends with a smile. Shall we go?
200 villagers sat in a ring around the grassy circle where the wrestling match was to take place. They all knew of the great insult that the American colonel had delivered to their beloved Aata, and they longed for justice, especially the old people who still chafed under French rule on the island, benign as it was. Varua was seated on a high-backed chair close to the chalk line that marked the combatants' arena. Next to him, on a much smaller chair, Keani sat silently, staring straight ahead, dreading the events that were about to unfold. Her brother had been clear. When the dust from the match settled and Colonel Scoundrel was carried, broken, and bleeding from the field, she was going to accept Aata's suit and consent to being married within the week. Now, in defiance of her brother's commandment, she looked across at Thomas and briefly locked eyes with him. He seemed so calm, she thought. Aata emerged from his hut like a demigod arising from the sea. His oiled, jet-black hair was swept back into a ponytail that trailed down his heavily muscled back, and his minuscule loincloth did little to hide his manhood from the villagers. Every inch of the warrior bulged with muscles and taut sinew. His biceps were the diameter of a coconut. The thighs with which he routinely crushed wrestling opponents looked sculpted from marble, and his abdomen was as solid and tight as battle armor. He soaked in the adulation of the crowd for a minute before throwing back his shoulders and striding slowly over to the grass ring, where he was going to slam this peacock of an American soldier to the ground over and over until he heard the man's spine snap and his voice cry for mercy. On the other side of the ring, Thomas slipped off the sandals he had taken to wearing since he came to Tahiti and loosened 2 buttons on his long-sleeved linen shirt. That was all the preparation he needed. He had stretched as they walked from event to event, and he had spent the last 2 minutes in meditative thought. Boswell and Aubert sat on rocks beside him, while McNab stood close for a final word before the combat began.
Given the choice between public humiliation or death, I can tell you that Aata would choose to die, said the captain.
Thomas looked into his friend's face.
Then humiliation it shall be,
he said with a grin, before stepping across the chalk line and walking to the center of the circle in front of Aata. There would be no formalities, no instructions, or rulings from Chief Varua. When the chief signaled it was time, the men would go at it, and they would continue until one man was no longer able to continue, either because of exhaustion, injury, or death. Thomas scanned the crowd of onlookers who were there to witness his total defeat at their champion's hand. If that meant the American colonel must die, so be it. He had been so arrogant as to think he could steal Keani away from her intended, and he had disobeyed the chief's warnings. These insults could not stand. He turned his head to Varua and nodded that he was ready, and then glanced at Keani and felt a deep sorrow in her gaze. Varua raised his hand for quiet.
This is your fight, Aata, he said. You will choose when to begin and when to end. My part is done.
He lowered his hand. The crowd began to cheer, and the fight was on. Aata took 2 steps back and smiled to the crowd. Then he turned to Thomas with a look of disdain and pity. The idiot didn't even know how to stand properly to fight, he thought, a sentiment shared by the crowd, who were mystified by the way that Thomas had spread his legs 2 feet apart, with his left foot forward and his knees bent at almost 90 degrees. His shoulders, knees, and even his toes were perfectly aligned, and his hands were thrust forward, bent at the elbows and tight against his sides. His head was erect,
motionless, his eyes boring into A'ata's. Then, as McNabb had promised, A'ata made his move. He stood straight and tall, threw his head back, roared, and rushed towards Thomas with his arms spread wide. "He wants to engage me in a bear hug contest," thought Thomas. "Not today." He lowered his body and shot forward towards A'ata's frontmost leg, wrapping both his arms around the warrior's leg as he pulled A'ata closer. He pushed on his opponent's hip with his shoulder, lifted his leg higher, and began to dance in a counterclockwise motion. To the people watching the match, the colonel's lightning-fast move was a blur of motion. One second, he was standing stock still in front of their champion. The next, he was stooping and exploding forward, holding A'ata's leg high in the air and making him spin around like a child. A'ata's arms flailed to help him stay upright, but there was really nothing he could do. Gravity and inertia were on the American side. Thomas spun around in a complete circle with A'ata twice, and then lifted A'ata's leg high over his head and pushed him back several feet. When A'ata tried to stop the backwards motion by putting all his weight on the one leg that had contact with the ground, Thomas slid his hands down the leg he was holding in the air and took hold of A'ata's ankle. The next time A'ata tried to hop forward, Thomas simply twisted the ankle and shoved the foot back. Then he let go and watched A'ata fall back into the crowd on his backside. The crowd roared, as much in surprise as in anger, that the mighty A'ata had been thrown to the ground in the first 5 seconds of the match. Aubert looked over to Varua, who had a Cheshire cat grin on his face. For her part, Kayani was fighting to hide her emotions, but the artist saw that her cheeks were flushed, and her breathing was fast. He shared a quick smile with Boswell and McNabb, and decided against lighting a new cigar. The match wasn't going to last that long. Thomas returned to his side of the ring and went back into his fighting stance. Now that A'ata had some sense of what he was up against, he was going to be far more cautious, and that meant more dangerous, too. The warrior flew up off the ground and advanced slowly towards Thomas, his arms down and close to his sides. He wasn't going to give the American another easy opening. Thomas didn't wait. He advanced straight towards A'ata until he was almost touching his chest, and just as quickly put his right hand behind A'ata's neck and his left hand on A'ata's right bicep. He snapped down on A'ata's neck just as the warrior responded the way that all untrained fighters did. He pulled back, and at the same time tried to raise the arm on which Thomas had the bicep grip. The instant A'ata's right arm began to move away from his body, Thomas released the grip on A'ata's neck, lowered his body, ducked his head under the arm, and swung around behind the warrior and onto his knees. He grabbed each of A'ata's ankles from behind, pushed hard with his chest against the warrior's legs, and controlled his fall to the ground. When A'ata tried to push himself up, Thomas waited for him to put his palms flat on the ground and start to bend his elbows. That was the signal for Thomas to throw himself on the warrior's back, thrust his hands and forearms under A'ata's armpits, and interlace his fingers behind the Tahitian's neck. He applied heavy pressure and brought his elbows back, causing A'ata to drop his face back into the dirt, gasping for air. This was the tricky part, Thomas knew. At this point, he could continue increasing the pressure until he broke his opponent's neck. Or he could ask the warrior to yield the match. Neither choice was a good one. So he picked a third way. He pulled his hands off A'ata's neck, stood up, and walked over in front of Varua's chair. The warrior coughed several times, turned on his side, and stood up, weaving slightly from side to side as he regained blood flow in his upper body. All around him, the crowd chanted and jeered. This was not the fight that they had come to see.
"You wish to end the combat?" Varua asked Thomas.
"I'd say he does," Thomas replied.
We can stay here all day, Chief Arua, but the outcome of this match is not going to change. He cannot defeat me, and I will not take his life. A'ata may have other ideas.
Thomas turned and saw A'ata walking towards him with a look of cold fury in his eyes.
It's time to end this, Thomas said. Varua shrugged and waved his hand in the air as if to say, not yet. A'ata deserves one more chance to recoup his honor. A'ata raised his fists and increased his speed. His strategy was to simply power his body against Thomas and pummel him to death, suffering whatever blows may come his way in the process. Thomas waited for the warrior to get within a few feet of him. Then he twisted his body perpendicular to A'ata, grabbed the warrior's left wrist, and in a great sweeping motion used A'ata's own momentum to hurl him into the air, do a somersault, and land flat on his back, coughing in pain. It was a classic Shurite move, one that he had used to great effect when wrestling in the 109th Regiment during the war. A'ata tried to push himself up on his elbows and catch his breath. Thomas walked over to him and pressed his foot down hard on the warrior's throat. A'ata tried to dislodge Thomas's foot, but he was too tired and in too much pain. "I did not come here to fight," Thomas said in a voice loud enough for all the crowd to hear. "I bear this man no ill will, and I choose not to do him any further harm." He looked directly at Varua when he spoke his next words. "I came here as a guest, and I will leave the same way." He removed his foot from A'ata's throat. "To those who would pursue this fight, know that I will not show them the mercy I have shared with this man." He looked down at A'ata, who was struggling to sit up. "Let this be the end of it," he said. Then he turned and walked past Keani and Varua without turning his head towards them. He did not notice Boswell, Aubert, and McNab fall into line behind him, or the crowd begin to disperse, and he did not see A'ata being helped to his feet by his friends. He walked to the edge of the water and looked out across the cloud-shrouded sea. Despite what he had just said, his fight with A'ata would not be over until one of them was dead. "One more burden to bear," he thought, "and I am losing count."